Pellicle is proudly sponsored by Loughran Brewers Select, a seventh generation family-owned business based near Dundalk in Ireland. In 2014, James Loughran established Loughran Brewing Stores in order to supply high-quality brewing ingredients to the burgeoning beer industries in the UK, Ireland and mainland Europe. The business expanded in 2022 when ingredient wholesaler Brewers Select joined the Loughran family, expanding its suppliers within the brewing ingredient and raw material industry. Some of those suppliers include Crosby Hops, a family-owned hop farm in Oregon, USA, Baird's Malt here in the UK, and industry-leading yeast producer Lallemand. Thanks to their support, we're able to pay more writers, photographers, and illustrators than ever before, and invest in special projects like this podcast. Thanks again to Loughran Brewers Select, who you can find out more about by visiting brewersselect.co.uk/pellicle. And now, let's get on with the show. Hello, and welcome back to another scintillating episode of the Pellicle Podcast with me, your host, Matthew Curtis. Today, I am very excited to bring you an interview with the current Beer Writer of the Year and author of Desi Pubs, David Jesudarson. He's not just a fantastic writer, he's become a really good friend of mine. And at last year's Indie Man Beer Con, the independent Manchester beer convention at the Victoria Baths here in Manchester, we sat down in front of a live audience and recorded this interview. More on that in a moment's time. First, if I'm sounding a little bit croaky, it's because I spent this week at the SIBA Beer X conference in Liverpool. Now, SIBA is the Society of Independent Brewers, or as they've just changed their name to, the Society of Independent Brewers and Associates. And BeerX is a conference that lets their members, many of the UK's small independent breweries, come together and take in seminars, visit suppliers, and to do lots of networking. And I got as much out of it as I possibly could. I hosted my own seminar. I caught up with lots of people, hence why I'm basically losing my voice. And I also had my little mobile podcasting rig with me. So I recorded a few sound bites with people. In a few weeks, I'll put together a state of the industry episode using those recordings, which I'm looking forward to bringing to you. In fact, thinking about the podcast, I've got a lot of stuff recorded and I'm really enjoying putting these episodes together for you. So what I'm going to try and do is publish one new episode every 2 weeks. I might not always manage it, but that's an intention I'm setting for you folks right here, right now. So let's see if I can stick to it and how long indeed I can stick to it for. Before we get on to our interview with David, I think it's worth just pausing for a moment and check in to have a think about some of the lovely beer and pub experiences we've been enjoying lately. Actually, this isn't a beer or pub experience, but a whiskey one, because a couple of weeks ago, I headed to the village of Ambergate in Derbyshire to visit the White Peak Distillery. And this came about in a bit of a roundabout way. I was commissioned by a new magazine in the US called Craft Spirits and Distilling, which is from the same people who do craft beer and brewing. And I asked if I could write about this bourbon called Never Say Die, which is made in Kentucky in the USA, and it's aged there in wooden barrels for about 6 years before being shipped over to the UK, where it spends the last 12 months in the same barrels, aging in the warehouses at White Peak Distillery in Derbyshire. And they call it an English bourbon, which is an impossibility really, because bourbon, to be legally called bourbon, has to be made in America. But there is no law that says once you've made the bourbon that you can move the barrels and finish it in another country. So that's what they've done to add a unique spin to it. And when I was researching it, I found that in my inbox 2 years ago, I was invited for a tour of the White Peak Distillery, which for some reason, I must have been really busy, I turned down. So I got in touch and said I'd love to come and chat about this Never Say Die bourbon, but also ask about their own whiskey, gin and rum. Their whiskey is under this Wireworks brand. The distillery is in this beautiful old wireworks right next to the River Derwent. So I spent a day with White Peak's founders, Max and Claire Vaughan, who gave me a tour of their distillery, their barrel room, and then, of course, I got to sit down for a tasting and work my way through some of their earliest whiskies. Now, they only started distilling in 2017. In the UK, to call something whiskey, it has to be at least 3 years old. So they're quite young whiskies, and you might be used to seeing 10 or 12 years on the label of a well-known Scotch whiskey, for example. But I was so impressed by what I found. The quality of the whiskey for such a young distillery, it kind of blew me away. And I left feeling like this might be a household name one day, and I want to write about them. So that's what I'm going to do. And I also recorded a podcast with Max, so that'll be out in a few weeks' time as well. Something that I really enjoyed taking away from that visit, though, was how they make their wash, which is the spirit equivalent of wort that you make when brewing. The distilling process essentially starts by making a beer, which is brewed and fermented. It's about an 8% liquid. It doesn't have any hops in it. But what I found fascinating about it is that some of the yeast they're using is taken from their neighbours at the Thornbridge Brewery. Yes, they use Jaipur yeast from Cask Jaipur to ferment their wash. And then the fermentation is completely open, like, for example, a spontaneously fermented beer. This is not spontaneously fermented. Obviously, they pitch the yeast I just mentioned, but they leave it open to the elements. And this allows it to get a little bit funky, a little bit weird. And it smelt incredible. And then they twice distill that into the spirit that goes into the barrels for aging. What I found when I tasted that raw white spirit, you'd expect it to be harsh and unpalatable because it's just come off the still. But it was remarkably delicious. It tasted almost like fresh pineapple. It had this huge, booming aroma of tropical fruit, a little bit of citrus. Their theory is that if you're putting something into barrel that already is packed full of flavor, all those esters from that brewing and fermentation process, then you're going to capture that in your eventual spirit, your whiskey. And that's what I tasted. So, yeah, I'm going to write about that in a few weeks' time. And you'll hear a podcast with Max soon. It was really nice for me to step out of my comfort zone for a little while at least. But I did have a lovely pint before I caught my train home, a pint of Everard's Tiger, a brewery in Leicester that's celebrating its 175th anniversary this year, which is pretty amazing. So that was nice to just, after lots of whiskey tasting, just switch off with a nice pint of bitter. Let's get on to our interview with David. Now, I first met David, and I say met David via email because he reached out to me in the early days of Pellicle to pitch some ideas, and he was very invested as a British Asian writer, and there are not many writers of colour based in the UK writing about beer, and he wanted to write about racism in beer and the inherent whiteness of beer writing, and two of his earliest pieces for Pellicle were on those very subjects. You can find them on pellicklemag.com. But not long after that, he pitched me this idea that he wanted to write about this concept of the Desipub and their role in society. And we commissioned and published that article, and it sent David down a rabbit hole. It became his life, really. He wrote several other articles on the subject for us and other publications, and eventually he pitched a book to Camera, the Campaign for Real Ale, and they published Desipubs last year. And it really is a fantastic book. On the surface, it's a guidebook to these pubs that serve the British Asian community, not wholly, but most importantly. They're focused around not just beer, but great food. Those mixed grills that David sends me photos of when he's visiting one of these pubs, they look absolutely incredible. He also wrote about where they fit within the UK pub scene on a socio-political level and the important history they play in British pub culture, an element of British pub culture that has barely been covered. Parts of what David has written about haven't been really covered at all. He broke vital ground with this book. What David has captured, not just with this book, with his writing, is he shows how many stories there are still to be told in beer and the importance of critical thinking and proper journalism within beer writing. So it was a pleasure to invite him up to Manchester to Indie Man Beer Con and to sit him in front of a small audience in the cellar underneath the Thornbridge Room, which you can hear in the background as we're chatting away, but it's not too disruptive, and chat about his book, his writing, and how he thinks about beer writing. So thank you to David once more for coming up for this interview, which we'll go to right now. Enjoy. I am over the moon to introduce the beer writer, my friend David, and I'm going to ask you how to pronounce your surname.
All your friends.
Surname properly.
Jesu Darson.
We are going to talk about his wonderful book, Desi Pubs. It's been described as the most important book about beer and pubs for 50 years by Phil Mellows in the Morning Advertiser. And I think the best question to get started with, David, is what is a Desi Pub?
So a Desi Pub is a British Indian pub. And so what that means is it's run by a guy of Indian origin, or a woman of Indian origin. And but I think that the key part is that they've stamped their identity on the establishment, whether that be through food most commonly, or music, or events. But the big question really is what does Desi mean? And it's a Sanskrit word, and it means homeland. And so it refers to people who have left the homeland, being India. And so that's a very sort of, for me, a very sort of romantic word that I like, because it sums up my identity as not being, I was born in this country. My dad was born in Singapore and he's of Indian origin. And so it has this connotation of trying to keep something from home to India. And it kind of joins a lot of people from, like me, who are children of the empire and had families who were displaced. And it manifests itself in pubs through the way that there's often very old-fashioned, they can be, in their decor, and lots of Sikh heroes, that kind of things, Indian instruments. And so it's that kind of mixing together of Britishness and Indianness.
So what motivated you to become so invested in Desi Pubs as a subject? Because it's been sort of an all-encompassing project for you. So how did, what was the spark? Where did it start?
So there's a congratulatory answer to that, and that's because I did an article in Pellicle about Desi Pubs, and I wasn't expecting anyone to really be interested in that, but there was a huge amount of interest. And I think the reason why I was kind of like not sure that it would take off in that way is because they never were part of my culture growing up. I grew up in Bedfordshire, a market town, and when I went to the pub, it was a very white space. I mean, I opened the door, and this is my first pint, and the people in the bar just looked at me, and some guy just shouted out, "Taxi!" like that, as if I was a taxi driver, because that was the only interactions they had with brown people, were that they were in the service industry, that kind of thing. And so I went through, like, in my 20s, I'd moved around the place a bit, but I'd been to, like, places that weren't, that were kind of very sort of, like, tolerant of me, very sort of safe for me to go in, but nowhere that was celebratory. And that was only until I went to the Blue Eyed Maid in Borough, in London Bridge. And this place was like a sort of dive bar, a karaoke bar, and there's nothing you would really recommend it, particularly in a place like this where there's loads of great beers and that kind of stuff. But what it had was, it was run by a Bangladeshi guy, and he had a team of brown bouncers, and it was great because I had this empowered landlord and I wasn't in a minority at times as a sort of brown drinker. And then I realized that there were sort of these kind of places when I went to Southall and Smethwick and everything. And then I just sort of thought to myself, well, why haven't we written about these? These places are amazing community spaces. They do great food and they have great social cohesion. Because they weren't just brown spaces, they were white spaces too. People, white people who lived in the area loved them and claimed them as their own. And that's where it started, really. And obviously, I like eating mixed grills. And
likewise.
And going around the country eating food and battling our transport network. And so that's where it sort of came about, really. And I didn't really think that everyone's... So there's always... Like, you might have noticed I'm caveating everything, but I think it's because Asian culture in this country has always been undervalued, so Asian people start to undervalue it ourselves, and that's what I've always felt like. But really, the book and the sales as everything has shown how amazing the whole subject is and how amazing Asian culture is.
Was there an initial Desi pub you went to that made you go, wow, and gave you that sort of motivation? And what was it about that pub that kind of spurred you on?
Well, there's two. There's three. So the first of all is the Glad in Borough, and that is like your modern Desi pub. Gaurav and Meg are brother and sisters, and they took over a very traditional London pub that did pies. And what they did is they did their Desi twists. They started serving chicken tikka pies, mutton paneer pies, that kind of thing. And they were very welcoming and hospitable, Desi hospitality, I guess. And then I went to the Scotsman in Southall, which was very sort of traditional, and it was a very sort of majority brown space. And that kind of opened my eyes up to how... That's a very Indian space. And then I went to the Red Bull in Smethwick, which was like the mixture of all the three... the Red Cow in Smethwick. And that was a mixture of all the three things, where that had a great black country welcome. So people were friendly as well as being brown or white. There was just this bar culture where you go in and they're interested in you. And I was kind of... I guess I'm a Londoner, so I was like, oh, I'm not sure how they'll take me. Will they hate me because I'm a Southerner? But they were the opposite. They were really nice. And so, and that's where I wanted people to have these experiences, to travel around the country and to see for themselves how welcoming these spaces were.
How did you go about researching the book? Was there a criteria you came up with? Like, did you walk into some place and go, oh, it's not quite a Desi pub, or it was, you know?
No, so the criteria was the landlord stories. So it was whatever they, how long they've been in the country, if they're willing to tell the story. So a lot of people will say, well, why isn't the Merry Maid in there, or why isn't this pub in there? And it's often because they didn't want to speak to me, or I couldn't speak to them. And so it masquerades as a guidebook, but really what it is, it's a celebration of people who've come to this country and forged a living for themselves. And not only that, have become very successful and very good at the sort of community cohesion aspects of it. But there were obviously some that I had to put in because people were like, I go, like the Tamil Prince in London, everyone tells me about it all the time. So I went there, it felt more like a restaurant, but I thought I'd write about it and put it in there. But the meat and potato, or whatever you want to call it, of the book are the big pubs in West London, North London, and West Bromwich and Smethwick.
That leads very nicely onto my next question, actually, because in reading the book, a lot of the pubs that feature are very centralised around specific regions, London being one, West Bromwich and Prestwich, you mentioned that, and Leicester, I believe, is another place. Why do you think Desi pubs are concentrated in certain areas? Because we'll get onto Manchester, because there isn't a Manchester Desi pub, although I do believe one has opened within the last few weeks, called Ale and Aloo. Yeah.
Well, I think, first of all, you've got to look at why they sprung up. They sprung up as safe spaces for Asian people who were excluded from other pubs. So the big one is Smethwick, which during from 1948 to the mid-60s had segregated pubs, or pubs that didn't serve brown people. And there was a lot of people from the Punjab region of India who went there to work in factories and that kind of thing. And so they needed to open their own pubs out to have this kind of space for themselves. So that's where that rich history came from. But then that doesn't fit the criteria for every region. So take, for example, Glasgow. That had Punjabis going there. But I think what happened is, and what it's been explained to me after going there, is that the reason they didn't spring up in Desi pubs was because they had a hours that didn't suit pub going. So they worked in industries where they didn't go to the pub afterwards and that kind of thing. And the same with Liverpool, has a very high concentration of Sikhs and Asian people. That had no culture of it. And I think maybe, I don't want to, you know, I'm not a social historian, but I think maybe that's to do with the fact that pubs always had a lot of Irish people in, and maybe they were less hostile to Asians. But I don't know, you know, the answer to that question. But, and in fact, that contradicts a lot of my research, which has found that the whole country had at some point segregation and the colour bar.
And I really want to talk a bit more about the Colour Bar in a moment, but have you heard about this new pub that's opened, Ale and Alu in Tildesley?
Well, yeah, whenever there's a new one that opens up, people will send me the details for, and there's hopefully going to be a second edition where it will be about three times as large, and then we can cover every single pub. And, like, the thing is that I've got family who live in Greater Manchester, so any of this would be music for my ears to go and visit them.
Fantastic. Well, sign me up for touring around Manchester with you eating some mixed grills. One thing I wanted to talk about is how a lot of the pubs, they fit a certain model. They, you know, I haven't visited a lot of them myself other than the Glad, which you describe as a modern Desi pub. But up north, we do have a craft beer and Indian street food chain called Bundo Bust. And I remember talking to you about this earlier in the book, like, are you going to include it? And, you know, it's somewhere I go quite often, and I find the crowd there to be quite diverse. Why would you not class something like that as a Desi pub?
Well, I think it's because they don't class themselves as a Desi pub. They're more of a street food place, restaurant. They have waiter service, that kind of thing. And I can see why you would say that, because they obviously do their own beers and that kind of thing. But, I mean, a pub to me is somewhere where you can just go for a drink. You probably can just go for a drink there, but it is serving a community and a community space. But they themselves, I think the biggest example of why I don't put it in is because at Christmas, they have their Christmas do in the people who run Bundo Bust in Birmingham, and they go to Desi pubs. So there obviously is some want and need to go to have Indian food in a pub space. And I think the kind of thing that pubs offer is that kind of communal sharing of mixed grills, which means that you can have lots of different types of, someone's not eating, someone is eating, someone's watching a football, that kind of thing. And, you know, they didn't start in the furnace of racial division. And also a lot of the modern Desi pubs started in places where the pubs were failing and they took over them. Whereas I don't know how these pubs, how the outlets were set up, but they seem to be very, like, you know, like high street, that kind of thing. You know,
well, I think that's a good chance to talk about what the Colour Bar is and how that affected British Asian drinkers for the last 40, 50 years, longer. So why don't you tell us a bit about what the Colour Bar is?
So I have three examples. So the most classic example of the Colour Bar is that we've mentioned it before, is Smethwick. And I think the best way to explain it is through the work of a guy called Avtar Jodhpal Singh, who was a member of the Indian Workers Association and a communist. And when he came to this country in the late 1940s, he found that the pubs were segregated, that if Asian people walked in, they had to go in the smoking room or the assembly, I can't remember which one. They weren't allowed in a lounge or whatever. And he was like, why are you accepting of this? And so what he did was that he went in with some white people and they would order a drink. And when he was seen to have the drink, he'd get chucked out. And so he'd write this down and then he'd give evidence to the magistrates. And so the landlord would lose their license. And that led to a lot of Desi pubs being set up in that area. He also famously introduced Malcolm X to the Blue Gates in Smethwick, and when Malcolm X walked in, he wasn't served as well. But this happened all around the country, and my second example of this happening is where I live in southeast London. There's a Wetherspoons there now called the Broccoli Barge, and that was a segregated pub up to the 1990s. So that had an Irish bar with white people only allowed in and a Jamaican bar, which black people were only allowed in. And that had even had separate toilets. So if you're a person who wasn't white, you had to go and use the toilets outside. Wetherspoons took over the pub. They got rid of the segregation and it ended in the noughties. It opened in 2000. And it happened all around the country. And the reason why I know all this is because I wrote the Wikipedia entry for UK racial segregation in this country. Because when I went on Wikipedia, it said racial segregation didn't exist in the UK. So I was like, what? So I spent a week writing all this down. And I went to each different region. And the Manchester one has a very interesting one. There was a boxer who was black called Len Johnson. And in the 1950s, he went to pubs in Manchester. And he went to one called the Old Abbey Tap House in 1953. And he wasn't served. served. And so he came back repeatedly, and there were protests about it, and eventually the landlord lost his license. And then the next year, 1954, there was this guy called Edward Adu, and he went to numerous pubs in Manchester and wasn't served. And he was a student. And what's interesting about this is that I had to go through the newspaper archive to find all this information. And they never, ever interview the person who's barred. They always interview the landlord. So you get the stupid explanations they give. Like, it's not a colour bar, it's a poverty bar. It's not this and not that. And so it was really quite difficult doing that page because you're reading about the incidents from the perspective of the racist person.
Are there modern examples of the colour bar still in existence today, would you say?
You want me to be really controversial and name
Oh, I don't do places. I don't do controversy. Everyone knows that.
I think what's interesting is that there's obviously very safe middle class spaces for white people. So they'll go to certain tap rooms and everything, and there will be totally at ease. But and someone described this quite well, is that you can come in and obviously they won't be tell you you're not going to be served, but your culture won't be celebrated. And I remember being in a tap room where it was just me and a few friends, and we were like, if you ask the people to put some Bangra music or whatever on Spotify, they're going to lose their Spotify password straight away. And so although there's never, you would say, segregation in that kind of outright sense, and you've got to remember that none of this was legal anyway, but it was done anyway in this country, is that we can find ways of finding segregation, of promoting it and people to be able to do it. But we always say, like, well, why does that happen in pubs? But you also should ask the question, why does it happen in restaurants? So if you go to a place like Hackney and there's a beer festival there, it'd be very white. But if you go to their restaurants as well, it'd be very white. And so if you want to call it segregation, it takes place through class and money lines, and you're more likely statistically, sociologically, to have less money if you're of colour and that kind of thing.
In addition to writing about Desi pubs, you do often relate to your own experiences of racism, and that seems to be, you know, you very much tend to centre yourself in that and then build the story out from a lot of those experiences you've had as a pub goer, which I think is one of your great strengths as a writer.
Having gone to the pub a lot, is what you're saying.
Indeed. But how important is the role of a pub, as someone who has spent a lot of time in them, in creating a more tolerant or
celebratory,
perhaps say a more anti-racist society?
Yeah. I mean, tolerant is a horrible word. I mean, you can tolerate someone but hate them. And that's ultimately like a word. And that's a word that like my parents would use, that they were very tolerant of us. And it's this idea, and I've been thinking a lot about it. I think ultimately the answer to your question is that, because I think about pubs a lot and I think about racism a lot. And so when I'm in pubs and I feel celebrated, I think that they're wonderful. And I think really a lot of people would love it if pubs were really inclusive everywhere. But that's just a dream, because society everywhere isn't inclusive. But what pubs offer is a third space. And we've been talking about this a bit. It's not your lounge. It's not your friend's lounge. It's someone else's lounge. And because of that, great things can happen, I think. And I think this is the thing that really annoys me the most, is that pubs offer so much of that, but they have to pay so much taxation when compared to supermarkets or whatever. And really, we should be looking at keeping pubs where possible because of this third space where we can come together. I mean, Desi pubs were brilliant in that some customers, white customers, were very hostile to brown people. But when they came in and sat together and drank together, it broke down the barriers. And I think beer is really good for that, or any alcohol, or anything where we have a commonality with people. And also, it lowers our... there are good and bad things to this, but our inhibitions being lowered can be good in the sense that it makes us talk to people. It also can be bad for other reasons that we all know. We all very well know the mental health implications of that.
Indeed, indeed. I spend a lot of time thinking about pubs as a third space, especially over lockdown. And then when we were allowed back in on the 21st of May 2021, it made me understand how vital this place that isn't work or isn't home is, and what that allows your brain to do. Like, physically spending time in a pub, it makes me feel better. It's not always about the beer or who I'm with. It's just being in somewhere that's nice and I can feel the shoulders relax. And that idea of a third space and what you can achieve in that
is pretty special, I think. And you recently wrote about one of these wonderful spaces, the Apray Castle Inn in Rye in Sussex. Now, that has a landlord, Jeff Bell, who's very outspoken. And you spoke a lot about how the way he interacts as a landlord and how that makes people... He makes it a political space in the way he engages, but he also kind of does the opposite. He depoliticizes it by making sure there's a fair debate. How important are figures like that and pubs like that in creating pubs that are more welcoming to all people?
I mean, it is tricky because a lot of people who read that article took it the wrong way, saying, well, he shouldn't be talking about politics. But he's of the opinion that it's his lounge, he lives there, he works there, why shouldn't he talk about politics? And I think this idea of... I think what I like about it is that I don't always feel comfortable talking about politics in pubs in the same way that my white friends do. And they're willing to have arguments and that kind of thing. But I think that what he's trying to stop is that kind of far-right chat. What's difficult is that far-right chat comes from newspaper headlines. It doesn't necessarily come from it doesn't come from some... I went to see Oswald Mosley the other day. He was amazing. Do you want to hear this? It comes from someone parroting rubbish from the Daily Mail, Daily Express. And so that challenging that, I think, is very difficult. Having worked in pubs for a lot, right-wing pubs particularly, in West London. And I think that it's admirable, but I'm not sure if it's replicable. You could go to the most tolerant places, and then tolerant, again, that word, most celebratory places, and then inside there will be people who will say off-colour things about immigration and that kind of thing. And that's because it's government policy. So it is a really tricky time, but I do think we need to meet this head-on and challenge it.
Yeah, absolutely. I very much agree, and I think talking about it is the way to really start those, start talking about it and hopefully inspire some action. Going back to the book, one of the few criticisms... I like to hang around this forum called Camera Discourse. I am a camera member and it has its own forum and it can get a bit spicy. And one of the criticisms I read on there is that a lot of the Desi pubs don't sell what you would call real ale. They don't sell cask beer. There's a lot of keg beer. There's a lot of mass-produced products. Do you think, or how do you think, that those pubs should maybe engage with smaller brewers? Is that something you feel could be a part of it? And I say that, in context, we are at a beer festival that is specifically designed to champion small brewers. And the book was published by Camera, which was specifically set up to champion cask beer, real ale.
I mean, so first of all, there are some pubs that do very good cask in there, but it is a trend, and I do agree. I think first of all, maybe the question slightly wrong is that the small brewers could try and champion themselves in their pubs, but I'm not going to be lying and romanticise it and say that they're going to be ultimately receptive, because what has happened is because of this tradition is that the tradition is very much sort of based on hard drinking. It's based on drinking on a price point, and the person who owns the pub, even though their customers are very modern, they're worried because they don't understand the beers of selling them. And they're often in areas where price point is very important. Southall, Smethwick, these aren't very rich places. But I do think there's a next generation of Desi pub landlords who are coming in, and they are getting engaged with craft, and you see that in a Tap and Tandoor, you see that at the Glad, and the Glad is very craft, but they only have one cask. But the sort of, I guess the other thing as well that's interesting is that maybe cask doesn't have the great image, and maybe it's an image that's associated with not the nice size of Britishness. And I say that with pain because I love cask. It's ultimately my drink. The first pint I had in that racist pub was a Wadworth 6X. And I've always liked the way that it's heavily sessionable, it feels more substantial than the keg equivalent for its ABV. So I would love it myself if they all had it. And also I think that they're battling against the marketing of giants like Cobra and Kingfisher, who make up these bullshit points that lager is the best drink to have with curries, and they're not. It's completely true. All food matching says that, your flavour profile should go with the food and the beer, so it should be lightly light pale ales. It should be all the craft stuff should be really good with this. So yes, it is disappointing, but it is a huge systemic problem, I think.
So you're one of the very few professional beer writers of colour in the UK. I think there's three. And you wrote a very powerful piece, one of the, I think it might have been the first piece you wrote for us before you wrote Desi Pubs, about how beer writing is quite a white space. I've got a few couple of questions here. What do you think could be done to encourage more writers of colour to write about beer?
How does a brown person fix the problems of systemic problems of white? Well, I mean, I say that as a joke because obviously it's valid to have my opinion on this. But the problem is that journalism in general is a white person's thing. It's not very well paid. It often requires people to have a secondary income, which usually relates to being quite wealthy. And also, I look at my own career. So, like, my own career started at a local newspaper. I was pretty happy working at a local newspaper. The local newspaper shut. I then had to get a job on the Nationals. I was trying so hard. But then people who were younger than me were working free of charge at these national newspapers because they were, I don't know, what do you call them? They worked free of charge and their parents paid support them in London. And so it's really, really difficult to even get to this stage where you can write about beer. But then the sort of the other problem is that it is a problem that beer writing is quite white, because if you look at the equivalent of food writing, now you told me when I interviewed this piece that when you the amount of color pictures from people of color you got were what 10% of
less than that.
So the equivalent you'd say for food for your website is Vittles, isn't it?
Yes, and I would say.
Yeah, so as near as you can get. So Jonathan Nunn said he got 50% of pictures from writers of colour. And I think that says a lot about beer and a lot about how it's not really seen as a subject that people of colour can write about. And I think that, like, it has to be said that the most... It's a failure, really, because beer is a very... inclusive product through price. It's not wine, is it? It's not. I mean, if you could ask this question about wine writing, like how many wine writers of colour are there? You know, how many winemakers of colour are there? I mean, I think there's only one in the country. And so it's very difficult, all these systemic problems. But I think that, like, that you cannot really sort of change things until the fees increase, and where you have more websites like yourself who invest in the journalism and really sort of want to have new stories. And I think that's key, isn't it? Because you're not really, if you're just publishing the same faces, you're never going to really get that diversity.
It's interesting, actually. We get pitches from students who say that when we say we don't have any money at the moment, they say we'll do it for free. And I just flat refuse that, because I'm left-wing and everyone gets paid the same. That's just how I think it should work. But it's a challenge. Interestingly, Pellicle does get a lot of pitches from LGBTQ writers. It might be because we have a visible... well, actually, 75% of the Pellicle editorial team identify as queer. So, you know, that's probably demonstrative of visibility. You know, Jonathan is himself, Jonathan Nunn at Vittles, is a writer of colour, so it creates, do you think it creates that visibility?
Well, no, I think that, like, I think that if you're LGBT, you're more, then the people who are pitching are white, aren't they? So they're more likely to be from middle class backgrounds. I think the answer about food writing is that there's definitely a trend in food writing for people who are obsessed with how people of colour's parents cooked, like it's some sort of authenticity and all this kind of stuff. And so Jonathan isn't entirely positive about all of that, because it means that we're engaged in the discourse on a very low level anyway. So it's not like a huge success story, but it is definitely more of a platform if you are of colour or the right. Yeah.
Well,
I mean, the real thing is that we're not really going to get diversity unless if we're getting working class voices. And I think that's what we really crave, is that I wouldn't mind it so much if we had that, or even diversity of age. I mean, beer writing is very old as well, isn't it? You know, like, so if we sort of change that, then we probably would get a chance to change the other thing as well. But it is really difficult.
You know? Absolutely. And if you are listening, you know, we do have a pitching guide on our website. Website. I've only had one third of beer and I'm already losing my speech. I did have more than one third yesterday, though. That could have something to do with it. Pellicklemag.com/pitching. We publish our rates. We believe in full transparency to try and make it as easy as possible for people to send us their ideas. And obviously, when people subscribe, we can then commission them and pay them to do that. Just one more question from me. You've mentioned that there is this idea of doing a second expanded edition, but what else is next for you? What projects are you eager to get your teeth into?
So I'm pitching a book that's about, the idea is called Bard, and it's about every single group that's been excluded from pubs. So as well as the colour bar, it will focus on women being excluded from pubs. It was legal to ban women from pubs until 1981, LGBT people, trans people, and also travellers. Because there's a crazy story that the Travellers Association used to hold their annual general meeting at the Coronet Pub, the Wetherspoons in Highbury. And one day they went downstairs after their meeting to get served, and they were barred because they were travellers. And so they took Wetherspoons to court, actually, and now it's illegal to do that. And I think that's like the last taboo of pubs. You know, because I mean, we all can remember signs saying no travellers, can't we? And yeah. It would always be. So I think that to do that, I think I probably want to have a bigger publisher. It's the key. So we're in talks with various people about that.
Excellent. And actually, there's a few traditional pubs in Manchester. A good example is the Peveril of the Peak, where one of the lounge areas was where the only place where women could sit in the pub, and you can still see the call buttons for service because they were forbidden to go up to the bar. But there's a couple of pubs in Manchester that have these call bells and that show an unfortunate side of our pub's past. That's all of my questions, but now I'd like to open this up to you, and I'll come and hand you the mic. If you have a question for David, please raise your hand.
Less of a question, more of a statement. I'm from Leicester.
What's your name, sorry?
Anand.
Hi.
So I'm from Leicester, where we've got a massive tradition of Desi pubs. They're all in working class areas. I don't know which ones, I've not had a chance to read the book yet, but I don't know which ones you've been to. I'm constantly in a group with my friends where one of them lives in London. So every time he comes back up to Leicester, it's always, all right, let's go out for a curry. They go to this place called the Indian Queen, just off Melton Road. And that's like their favourite place. And then when I moved up here 12 years ago after I got married, not having access to a Desi pub really affected me, because it was a place where you can go that the beer is relatively cheap. So, I mean, as long as you're fine with having macro lagers and macro bitters and that sort of stuff, that's not a problem. But it's having access to a space, like you've said, where you can just chill out. There's no pressure. The food is of the highest quality because it's all by chefs from India who have come over and just want to put their craft into making good quality food. Whereas what you find in restaurants,
curry houses.
Yeah, in curry houses, the taste is always for the white palate. It's never for the Indian Asian palate. Yeah. Whereas you go to a Desi pub, it's food that you would have at home, but that slightly more kind of authentic-y taste, because no one's got a tandoor at home. No. So going for a mixed grill was a treat. So we used to do that quite regularly before I moved out. So now that we've got the Ale and Alu, which has opened a couple of weeks ago, with luckily that side of town.
Is it good?
I've not had a chance to go yet. Yeah. It's on the list. Yeah. Just trying to find a date. I'm excited about that because for 12 years I've been crying out for somewhere like that. So I'm hoping that will be the start of a new revolution in Desi pubs within the Northwest, because it doesn't have that.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I've always said I mean, you'll attest to this. I've always said for the past 12 years, why doesn't Manchester have that? We've got a massive Asian community in Preston, in Burnley, in Blackburn, although that's mainly Pakistani origin, whereas you look at places like Birmingham, Leicester, Southall, Wembley, and that's mainly Indian origin. So that's probably where it's come from, that Desi pubs have sprung up, because obviously the Pakistanis don't drink, so they've never really had that space, and their social space is mosques, where they've had to meet each other and hang out. But for people who are in factories, their release was a pub. And there's plenty of pubs around Leicester that my dad and my uncles were like, oh yeah, we used to go to this club, we used to go to this club. And it was always like little old working men's clubs that they've taken over. But yeah, that's mainly it. It's just...
There wasn't a question there, though, was
there? No. I did say it's more of a statement than a question.
Well, I mean, like, what I found in Leicester... So it's a big reveal is that there's only one in Leicester in the book, because I was looking for something very different in the sort of East Midlands, and the one in the book is totally different to all the Desi pubs in the rest of the country. Paddy St Martin's at the back, and so when yes. the second edition comes, I will go back. And I've been, but Leicester is very, very important for the one reason that it has the first ever Desi pub, the Durham Ox, which opened in 1962. And I went back since the book's been published, and it's now brilliant. They've redone the kitchen. It's new people doing the kitchen. I think it's the same guy who owns the Owl and Pussycats, or but this idea of trying to create them in the future is that I don't know if they'll ever be as good as the ones that are established, because the culture and how it works is always in there. So I'll be very interested to know what the Manchester one is like. Because it's really important what you say, is that a curry house isn't a safe space for brown people. It was a white space. So it was people of Bangladeshi origin doing approximation of what they thought Indian food was. But I don't want to denigrate what they do, because they put up with more racism than anyone else. But the food is, they have the large menus, they have a lot of colorants, pre-made sauces, that kind of thing, heavily salted. And Desi pub food, like you say, is... because there's so many in concentrations, they compete against each other, and so they have to be about quality. And so yeah, but when you go to Leicester and the Curry Mile and everything, you'll really be interested in this one in the book, actually. They do egg curry and things like that.
Yeah,
you know? So like, yeah, but yeah, well, thanks very much for that.
No worries, thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions? We've got plenty of time.
Hi David.
Hi.
What struck me in the book was, I guess, you know, as you said, it's not really, it's not, you know, it's not a restaurant guide. It does talk about the food, but I love the book. And it was really, really affirming to kind of hear stories around, you know, first generation, second generation immigrants, maybe people that have taken over the pubs from the original landlords, or sometimes it's not the same owner that took it over originally, the first Desi generation, but then people that had worked in the pub then kind of took it over. But it felt quite uplifting. And, you know, again, you know, you kind of feel that it's not about tolerance, it's about acceptance, it's about celebration, it's about understanding that this is part of modern Britain. Was that an intentional angle that you wanted to do, or did that just come out from meeting those stories and seeing those places? Because as you have not always had great experiences drinking around the country... And you don't always feel that those spaces are welcoming or celebratory, but, you know, sadly, I've not visited too many of the places yet, just the London ones, but I'm looking forward to going on a tour and experiencing that properly now, firsthand.
So I mean, the start of it was just to change the default of what a landlord is, to change it from being a white middle-aged man. And then this complete surprise when I embarked on the project was the fact that these were diverse spaces, that these were white people in their pubs who actually could call them their Desi pubs, and they'd have like a mixture of Punjabi words, and I'd be like, actually, you're living a more multicultural life than me, because I live in a sort of very white middle class area, and we don't have these kind of things. And so it, the real intention, I always say this to people, is to don't just go to the ones in London, don't just go ones gyms in Birmingham, go all around the country, experience it all and see all the different parts, because it shows that if we go and do that, then we're getting out of our safe spaces and our sort of social groups and everything like that. And I think that was the key part of it, because these are post-racism places. They might have been built on being a reaction against the colour bar, but they're now something very different. And I think that there is no cringe element to white groups going to the football and going to a Desi pub beforehand. It's part of their routine. It's been like that for 15, 20 years, maybe more.
Could you please give David a huge round of applause? Thank you. Thank you so much for making your way to Manchester. David is one of my favourite people to speak to. And as you might have heard, he has become a really good friend as a result of our work. But mostly what we talk about is cricket and our fantasy Premier League teams. But there is as much value in talking about those things as there is talking about the socio-political beer and pub landscape, which we do like to get into as well. Thank you again to David for joining me for that interview, and thank you for you folks for listening. If you find what we do at Pellicle valuable, be it via this podcast or via pellicklemag.com, do consider becoming a subscriber for the price of a pint a month. We are paying writers, photographers, illustrators every week to produce the content you see and hear, and we really want to be able to pay them a bit more money. We want to be able to support ourselves as editors so we can spend more time working on Pellicle. And we've got some other exciting projects like merchandise and other assorted things that we'll be investing in once we've got the funds. And lastly, one other thing you can do is come and join us on the 11th of May in Manchester at our block party, our fifth birthday party, which we're hosting over four brewery tap rooms: Track, Cloudwater, Sureshot and Balance. You can find out a little bit more about that if you head to our Instagram page. And once we've got our lineup of talks and tastings all scheduled, I'll add a post to the site as well. But keep the date free, May the 11th here in Manchester. It's free to attend. There'll be a few surprises, a few collab brews and a lot of fun. I'm most looking forward to the Pellicle Pizza Palace with our friends at Slice Culture Pizza, which will be on at the Track Brewery tap room until they run out of pizza. And I really like those pizzas, so you better get there quick before I literally eat them all. That's it for me for this week. Next time, I'm chatting to Alistair Morell from Cider is Wine. If you're one of our Cider listeners, you will not want to miss this interview. This is someone I've had a few disagreements with, but actually, the podcast, when we got to sit down and talk face to face, we found a lot of common ground. So hopefully I'll have that with you in 2 weeks. Until then, I have been Matthew Curtis, and you have been listening to the Pellicle Podcast. See you next time.